This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Neo-san and company, for inviting me to speak. I feel honored. And today I have something to talk about that's of urgency for me, and I don't know, maybe for you. Of course, for those in Canada, it's newsworthy, and part of it is newsworthy from the Sangha family as well. For those here, we have to understand what we feel called to do. So, of course, I'm referring to this week's events, in which, Defense Secretary James Mattis had made a lot of announcements about how the military was going to go, how the review was going to go. But in contrast to that stated process, on July 26, a couple days ago, in three progressively more and more shocking tweets, President Trump announced that 15,000 transgender people now serving will be banned from military service. And though they say nothing is happening right now, that's not nothing. Being put on notice like that is not nothing. And so we have to know that being put on notice for people who have already lived with oppression in our lifetime would be of a greatly triggering nature, even if nothing else occurred. And so what he said was, after consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the U.S. government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity. And later, Sarah Huckabee Sanders said this was a military decision. This was about military readiness, about unit cohesion, and about resources, which is the myth and not the truth. Which is actually that less than 0.01% of the budget is spent on, military budget, is spent on specific spending for transgender people. And the other thing that happened this week was that in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, the Justice Department inserted itself into an appeal in Zarda versus Altitude Express, you know, the high diving company, where the guy was fired because of his sexual orientation. And so this was an appeal. And the U.S. government inserted themselves in the conversation in the form of an amicus brief, which stated that in their opinion, in the opinion of the Department of Justice, Title VII doesn't apply. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act doesn't apply to workplace discrimination based on sex. And this is in contrast to the federal position that has been upheld for and developed for decades and is currently being upheld by EEOC and other agencies within our system. So both of those, both what was happening in the military before and also what's been happening in terms of equal opportunity and in terms of marriage, had kind of begun to still the environment of triggering distrust and fear that had been the unacceptable norm for a long time. And that it comes up again is a deeply disturbing. And so the question arises, well, how do we practice with this? And who are our models? What do we do? So the first thing I want to say is that in a practice life, practice comes first. So that we don't have strategies or reactions are not good enough. We have to understand response, which means that we have to give ourselves the supports that we need to go deeper than any event or any conditioned reaction. And that's not so easy to do, but if anybody's going to do it, we have to do it. So we need to understand who our models are and how they work. So today I'd like to speak about three role models for Zen teaching. And I would also like to give some of Suzuki Roshi's teaching, which was applied in different circumstances, but which I think is very valid. So I don't know if you know the koan, Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha. Do you know that koan? So this is an old translation. This is a William Shaw translation that Suzuki Roshi gave a number of lectures on when he looked like this. Okay, so this is a picture of Suzuki Roshi before he came to America, and the following year or two he was giving lectures here. And this is an excerpt from one of those lectures. So the introduction says, one gesture, one posture, one word, one verse. If one plans such a teaching approach, that's like gouging out wounds in healthy flesh, making holes and cavities. So there's slang for this. The great activity is before us, manifest. There are no regulations in it. If you plan to make known that there is an absolute throughout the whole heaven and the whole earth, the search for it will not succeed. Supposing one does attain, and what if one doesn't? An extremely small matter. Supposing one doesn't attain, well, what if one does? An extremely critical matter. If you don't pass along either of these roads, what is the right thing to do? I tentatively put this before you. Ponder it well. And this is the main case. Attention. Basso, the great teacher, was unwell. I should add that he was dying, actually. The temple's chief administrator visited him. Teacher, during these recent days, how is your health? And the great teacher responded, Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha. Okay, so the exchange is that the teacher's dying, unwell. The attendant approaches him, who's the head administrator, approaches him and says, how are you? And he says, Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha. Now, not in Shaw's translation, but in Kaz Ta-Nehisi's translation, in Tom Cleary's translation, there's a poem that's a commentary for this. Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha, what kind of people were the ancient emperors? For 20 years, I have studied this diligently. How many times have I entered the Green Dragon's cave for you? This response is worth recounting. Clear-eyed, patch-robed monks should not take it lightly. So clearly, his response is to clearly the case the words of the commentary and verse are about understanding what kind of people were the ancient emperors and finding how we ourselves are like the ancient emperors and what ancient emperor quality draws forth a response from us instead of reaction. For 20 years, I have studied this diligently. Okay? So clear-eyed patchwork monks should not take this lightly. So, but Suzuki Roshi's words on the subject are, though you're looking forward to the bliss of teaching or passing on the Dharma, which can happen horizontally as well as vertically, you do not know that you're always in the midst of the teaching, the Dharma. So even that, those tweets and those decisions and briefs arise in the midst of the Dharma and are the Dharma in some inconceivable way. So your practice does not accord with your teachers or with the ancient way. Once you realize Buddha nature within and without, there is no special way to follow for a student or any specific suggestion to give for a teacher. And then Suzuki Roshi says, when there is a problem, there is the way to go. So it means we have to roust ourselves around from running away from the problem or reacting to the problem and understand that here is the way, here it unfolds, and that the problem gives rise to the solution if we sit with it and understand from where our response needs to come. And then he gave us an even further refuge, deeper refuge, that actually you continuously go over and over the great path of the Buddha with your teacher who is always with you. Negative and positive methods, or the first principle and the second principle, are nothing but the full function of such a person. Buddha nature is personal to you and essential to all existence. Which doesn't mean that we don't have to do anything. So let me give you some role models. There's so many role models I could talk about who I'm not talking about today. You know, John King, Blanche. There's just so many people. But today I specifically want to discuss Isan, Del, and Jhana. Okay? Isan because he passed away, and Del and Jhana because they are passing away. And we should know that. Del, I don't know if he's gone already, but I received word that Del Carlson is, he's in his last stage of life. Jhana's in home hospice at Jikoji right now, where she is practicing with severely metastasized lung cancer. And so she and I spoke at great length the other day, and I'll speak to her again as soon as I can. But she's in a good frame of mind. She's practicing. It's incredibly inspiring. So we should know that. So Isan, I don't know if you know that Isan was a Navy man who was dishonorably discharged for his same-sex relationship. And we know this, from Tensho David Schneider's book Street Zen. If you didn't know Isan personally, you do know that he created the Party of Four that went all over the place, which was a party in four people. And he was an entertainer, a prostitute, drag queen. He was called Tommy D, the boy who looks like the girl next door. You know. He was a speed addict. He knew Lenny Bruce and did various substances with him. He did LSD. He saw during his trip, he was sitting at the altar and he saw a photo of Ramana Maharshi and saw into him and had a deep spiritual experience and spent the entire trip staring into Ramana Maharshi's eyes and kind of realizing that there was something other than what he was, than the life he had been living. So he came to sit Zazen in the late 60s and befriended Philip Whalen, the beat poet who was his Zen, one of my ordination brothers, and an abbot here after Issan. And so Issan always, I would sometimes ask him, because he was ordained several years before I was, and I would always ask him, well, what do you think I should do to give a talk? And he said, I don't know, I don't read. And I said, you must read something. And he said, yeah. He read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind many, many times and had parts of it memorized, as a matter of fact. And he would respond mostly from his own understanding of practice. He was also one of Okasan's, Mrs. Suzuki's, favorite tea students. And he did a lot of things for her. They had a wonderful relationship. As a matter of fact, one time, we were eating dinner on the occasion of Okasan's maybe 60th or 65th birthday. I can't remember what it was. And Issan was there, and he always dressed really properly. You know, he was always incredibly well put together. His head was always newly shaved, and his little collars were always bleached. And, there was always just that much of them showing, and it was even from top to bottom. And he excused himself for a minute, and we thought he was going to his bathroom, going to the bathroom, and then who should come in through the kitchen door but Marilyn Monroe, singing the full JFK, a happy birthday to you, like that. Anyway, he did it much better than I could. And Okasan was rolling on the floor. I mean, she practically peed her pants. It was really funny. And he was good at what he did. Okay. So anyway, he was ordained by Zen Tatsu, Richard Baker Roshi, and he was not perfect. So I sometimes caught him sneaking into the cabinet under the bananas in the kitchen to get the alcoholic substances there and take a little tot in the middle of the night. And he would admit everything and make promises. Anyway, he founded Maitri. He convinced Steve Allen to run it against Steve's many times stated protests. Eventually, Steve became abbot here too. And he founded Hartford Street Zen Center, which had been the gay Buddhist club. And he inherited this house. And he opened up the wall between Hartford Street and Maitri, which was right next door through the bookcase in the living room. There was a big archway, and you could go back and forth and volunteer. And at his mountain seat ceremony in 1989, you see a picture of him at his mountain seat ceremony on the mantle, and Pam Jackson is sitting in there. And one of the things that the abbot does is to go from altar to altar saying various blessings. And when he got to the front door, you could hear him. The room was completely packed and sweaty, and you could hear him say, all the other verses were more complex, but he said, as long as I am alive, this door will always remain open. That's the only thing he said. And he did AIDS care at Maitri like Mother Teresa washing the feet of people, because she saw them as Jesus. And but it was more immediate than seeing people as Jesus. He saw them as himself. He saw the people at my tree as himself. And like, for instance, J.D., who was the first Maitri patient. J.D. had been given kind of a death sentence, and then Isan took him in, and J.D. lived for another 2 years, and it was a big problem for the hospice people. He thought he should have, you know, that you don't come to hospice to live. And Isan lived in the now. Like, for instance, I would have arguments with Isan about James. James was a speed addict, methamphetamine addict, but he and his brother died of various diseases from infected needles. But James was also Isan's lover. And I would confront Isan and say, you know, Isan, you just practically admitted to having unprotected sex with James. And Isan would say, so? I don't see that that's any of your business. And I'd say, Isan, you made it my business when we became Dharma brother and sister. And Isan would say, I love James now. You know, it was that kind of conversation. And like when Isan was dying in Steve's arms, they invited me to come over. Isan wanted to be a little more comfortable, and I'm an Iyengar yoga teacher. And so I brought various pillows and, you know, around and did some stuff with pillows, and he was a little more comfortable. And when I went to leave, he said, see you later. And I said, Isan! And he said, what? Weakly, because he was dying. And I said, you said see you later. What are you talking about? And he got irritated with me. He said, what does anybody mean by see you later? You know, so anyway, he really lived in the present. He drove me mad a lot. Like when I was work leader and Isan was director, one time he asked me to clean the San Francisco Zen Center storage areas. And they had about 150 people's things in them from the apocalypse that San Francisco Zen Center went through. So I cleaned as best I can and gave, after a lot of song and dance, tried to give everybody back their things. And then Isan went through, and like Leona Helmsley, he ran his finger along one of the surfaces, and he kind of looked at it, and then he held it to my face. Anyway, just saying. Okay, so, but stuff, he agreed with us about Sun Face Buddha, Move Face Buddha. He would say stuff like, the path is under your feet. And he really, what I was thinking of as Leona Helmsley, he also taught as Memmitsu no Kafu, which was that careful attention to details is our family style. So there were two sides to everything he did. And he said, the definition of compassion I like is endless dimensions of this moment. If you begin to discuss it, you've missed it. It's more a question of being compassion. Okay, so anyway, there's just so many more things I can say about him. But what does he mean as an example for us? Well, his unshakable devotion to being in the present and staying with what's important, which is unconditional love and support and absolute truth in the midst of all of the like shiftiness of being a normal human being. That's what I would say is a good example for us. So we can accept the shiftiness of being a normal human being with limitations. We can admit it thoroughly, and then we can respond because we're free. We can react. Instead of reacting, we can respond. And his response was to open Hartford Street. And his response was to not only treat people at Maitri like himself, but actually to see them as himself. So I've got two other people, Del and Jana, but I also saw some restless knees. Do you want me to go on or?
Yes.
Okay, but could somebody, what time is it now?
It's quarter to 11.
Quarter to 11? Well, what should I say? In about 5 minutes, we should have questions and answers, but I want to talk about Del, and then maybe if we have time to discuss Jana, maybe it's in tea. Or maybe I get to discuss both of them. Would that be okay? Okay. So Del Carlson was born on December 3rd, 1923. He's 94 years old, and he's lived in Sarasota for the past 13 years in Florida with his relatives. And Del went to San Jose State College, and the Spartan Daily of April 13th, 1943, lists Del as having been an underclassman in the Marine Reserves. And he took the screening test in the following week. And at that time, reservists would automatically be transferred to active duty. He did active duty. He fought in World War II. He shot people in the Pacific. And he played organ in the chapel at Saipan. And the chapel was always packed, but when the Enola Gay went and bombed Hiroshima, no one came to the memorial service, and that struck him. And so that struck him so deeply that he decided that if he made it home, that he would explore the spiritual path and find out what it was, which led him to be interested in Jung archetypes, how the collective unconscious makes itself known in present life, and also in Buddhism. And so Del illustrated Tassajara cooking, the Tassajara bread book. So you'll see those pictures of people's hands. They're kind of line drawings. They're immediate. They give you a sense of confidence. Those are Del's. He actually taught art after getting his master's at Stanford, after he did get home. And so his first experience of sitting quietly was during a seminar on the teachings of Jesus at Stanford. And he was part of the beat scene, and when there was a Stanford group experimenting with LSD, he joined it and took it. And he traveled to India and Thailand. And then he read the brochure that was fundraising for Tassajara, which I don't know if you've seen, but it has photos of mountains on it. And Tassajara was bought almost entirely with $5 and $10 donations and like tickets to the Zenithon that the Jefferson Airplane did for us with a number of other artists and so on. And Del saw the brochure and he thought, oh, wow. And so he decided to go to Tassajara in the summer of 1969 as Yvonne's guest. Yvonne Rand took him there. And so he was eligible for a sabbatical from art teaching. And so when he was there, he met Issam. And they became friends. So if you go to the internet, you'll see a photo. There's this great photo of Issam and Del. Del would come to Tassajara every summer for at least a week, sometimes 2 or 3 weeks, and he would just stand at the back of the kitchen and chop onions. And his onion chopping was amazing. So he would make exactly small, medium, or large dice, or half moons, or quarter moons, whatever the Tenzo wanted him to do. And you would always have these amazing onions. And onions are the basis for a lot of the guest cooking, to add the flavor there. But they're not really noticed. But he did the onions really perfectly. Not perfect, anal, compulsive perfect, but perfect like being with each onion. You know, onions are round, they have layers, and they're hard to cut because you cry. But he just kind of did it all the time. And then later he decided to travel throughout Asia. This was in the 60s, 70s. And he stayed with Zen, but he always practiced very, very humbly as a layperson. And his teaching was through his art and how he was with people and through just staying ordinary. He didn't want to be a priest. He and I would talk about it sometimes. He just did not want to get ordained. He wanted to be ordinary. And just, he didn't say ordinary. He just, he would say stuff like not special, not rigid. He saw the hierarchy at San Francisco Zen Center as rigid. And the he thought that eventually it would just, that places like San Francisco Zen Center and I don't know what size down to, you know, how small you got before you didn't get rigid, but he saw places like San Francisco Zen Center as going into a terrible sort of sunset where we would just follow the forms for the sake of the forms without the actual feeling of what was going on, without a human feeling, and it would just degenerate worse and worse, and then finally it would die a slow and tedious death. So that was his view of what we were doing, and it was actually put into, you know, it actually had some reality for him when he got sick in 2003 or 2004, I can't remember. He and I had some conversations about his will, in which he was leaving a lot to San Francisco Zen Center, and where to put it, and how to do it, and so on. And when I, you know, I tried to get it saved, but, you know, as things happen in a big organization, it got lost, so that was one thing. And then he got really sick, and no one visited him for 3 weeks from San Francisco Zen Center. So he wrote San Francisco Zen Center out of his will, and was very disenchanted with the institutionalization of religion. And so I actually think that how Dell can be an example for us is that this kind of hard-headed look at what happens to institutions if they become rigid, and his emphasis on not having any special marks and of just attending to what he was doing, like the onions, is an incredible example of lay teaching, which the point of lay teaching is given who I am, what my talents are, what my responsibilities are, what I feel moved to do, the shape of my life as it is. How does the Dharma arise here in this shape, hand in hand with all beings? So that's lay teaching, as opposed to priest teaching, which should be, given the form that the Buddha transmitted, can I manifest it, body, speech, and mind, so that it can arise for the next generation? But he said that priest practice tended to devolve and degenerate into a sort of institutionalization, where it became rote. And I think priest practice needs lay practice, that form needs no, you know, the form of teaching, the institutionalized form, needs the non-institutionalized checking of actual human relationship, love, life, to give it ongoing meaning. And I think this is true of our government and our relationship with the institutions of democracy as well. So I think it's important for us to think of what is a formed democracy, this kind of hierarchy of transmission that exists, and how do we respond to it or keep it every day? How do we actually practice with it, with truth, and with a sense of life in the present moment, and not lose ourselves to even rote protests, but how do we use our energy appropriately? So I think that's his teaching in this situation. Anyway, I just want to mention that the third example is Gengetsu Janadraka, Gengetsu Junsei, mysterious moon, complete spirit. ordained and received Dharma transmission from Blanche. I was her instructor. She was born as Elizabeth Ann Potts in, what was the name of the place? Scotland in, oh, I have it written, Falkirk, Scotland. And she lived the high life in the 60s, including several years stint in Amsterdam. She was a masseuse, and she did like natural ritual, and was kind of in the wise woman tradition. And she came to the U.S. in 1989, and I knew her very well in all of her time at San Francisco Zen Center, and I've also known her on the street and through her time at Jikoji and now. And I'll talk more about Jhana during the Q&A or the tea. But, you know, I worked with her in San Francisco Zen Center's outreach department, and as she was beginning to study harm reduction and develop her street ministry. She currently, and she still does from her bedside, have a ministry to low-income and homeless people, which really was inspired by Isan's work. So she and I had many conversations about Isan as a role model, and also some of the people in Religious Witness for Homelessness. Blanche and John and I talked about her entering Faithful Fools when she did that, and we'll talk about her more, but I think it must be time for Q&A. But anyway, let's just say compassion really strongly expresses itself in these lives of these three people, you know. And if we sit with it rather than like analyze it too much, it'll give us a sense of sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, a sense of how to respond instead of react, a sense of how to practice with even being deeply triggered or oppressed or being the ally of someone who is. So I'll be quiet now, and please feel free to comment or ask.
I was really interested in the connection between Jhana and Isan, because I've also read a little bit about Jhana's work and her kind of street Zen approach.
Yeah.
Did she actually work with Isan before, or was it just from the stories handed down to her that inspired her?
Well, she and Isan knew each other
okay.
a little bit.
Right.
Yeah. But not much, because
okay.
remember, she came in 1989.
Yeah, I
Isan died shortly after
sure.
that. But she and Isan, she was introduced to Isan, I happen to know,
okay.
and had good conversations with Isan, and also heard about his work from a lot of people here. Jhana has given lectures here and been Doshi here. Maybe she hasn't done that recently, but she was no fool when she was working, and she also would speak with John King and with Daigon and Blanche and other people, maybe some people who are here in the room. I don't know. Anything else?
I know Dale Carlson as well, and was there any way that you were able to patch it up with Zen Center? I mean, not necessarily with the will, but I mean, I'm saddened to hear that, you know, he was so
disenchanted.
I mean, because he really loved it. When I was at Tazahara as a young man then, you know, he was always there in the summer, and
yeah.
we'd read together at night and go out on the days off, and, you know, he just really liked that character, and
yeah.
sad to hear that.
Well,
know.
He's been in touch with a number of us.
Okay.
And notably, he's been in touch with Leslie James
okay.
at Tassajara and some other people. And Dell is quick to anger and thorough in his forgiveness.
Oh, yes, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Let's just say that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Anything else?
Should know what we're saying. Yeah, Eduardo.
I appreciated your story about, I loved it. I kind of chuckled when you said the frankness of catching Isan sneaking a little bit of the booze. I think it's interesting because it invites my mind to think either ill or something else.
Right.
And I think it reveals a little bit about my own mind, right? What choice did I quickly make? And my choice was compassion and invitation to, if this can happen amongst all this, you know, this idealized version of even Buddha, then I'm included in that.
Yeah, that's one side.
That's right.
The other side is, Isan quit it. You know, there's people in recovery here.
Yes.
You are actually hurting people by doing this.
Yes.
And the other side, is, like Jana used to call one of the things that she did, Isan's way. Like there was a woman who she was talking to. Sorry to interrupt. But
no.
That's okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Please,
I appreciate
continue.
It. But there was a woman who Jana was talking to who was a shoplifter and couldn't bring herself to stop shoplifting dresses and skirts wherever she went. And so she was talking to Jana and she said, I can't stop. And Jana said, well, when I was a teenager, I was a shoplifter. And I used to, and she described some shoplifting incidents, and then the woman said, wow, you know, if you can practice, I can practice. And that's been Jhana's method, like the accessibility of being equal with people and admitting her faults as part of talking about where you come from and where you go to in practice. It sounds simple. But as Mrs. Suzuki said, when I tried to imitate her miso soup and failed horribly, simple is not easy. So there's a lot in that. Jhana actually was using the principles of harm reduction. So she was trying to train people to take responsibility for their own addictions and behaviors, and she still is from her deathbed, or she might actually be with us for 2 years, we don't know. But the end is definitely in sight, and she's upping her teaching. Like as Katagiri Roshi said, Suzuki Roshi said, things teach best when they're dying. You know? So Jhana definitely has an understanding of her own mortality, and she's applying that as people come and help her, her students come and help her. So there's both sides. Harm reduction doesn't say that there's no harm in addiction. The point is to minimize the harm. And Jhana's idea, which she got from Isan, was that a step towards honesty and responsibility is a step in the right direction. So thank you for bringing that up. Yes, Ty.
I just want to say thank you so much. Sharing all these tales, stories from first-hand experience, witnessing or being there. I think it's really important for so many Zen practitioners to hear this kind of stories because, you know, you guys being like pioneer and part of the beginning of the Zen practice in America, so practically history figures in 50, 100 years, you know. And oftentimes we don't really hear the first-hand stories, you know, from here and there, but mainly from the book.
Yeah.
And so many people are dying, or we're all dying, but they're dying, you know, they started dying. And so it's like second generation of Zen practitioners in America, and like now the seniors, elders. So I really appreciate
so
to hear, to learn, and we carry on these stories to the next generation in 50 years, and so on.
And something something I think that we also need to do is to hear the stories of the people who haven't been acknowledged yet mm-hmm. as part of the spread of American Buddhism. Like if you think about the Issei, Nisei Japanese community, and you know, those people were practicing Buddhism, and some of those teachers who came here supposedly to teach us actually came here to be heads of temples there, and like in the Chicago Exposition, or as early as the Chicago Exposition, or even in the 1870s, there were Chinese, Japanese people practicing Buddhism and practicing Zen in San Francisco. Came into the public eye, you know, in kind of mainstream society eye, in the Chicago Exposition of 1893,
mm-hmm.
the Parliament of World Religions, but it had been part of this country. Only mainstream didn't acknowledge it. So how do we include all of those stories? How do we think of all of those stories as real? How do we make our response from a 360-degree awareness? And I think that Jhana's and Issan's approach was to do that. Their idea of unconditional acceptance and to have that come, have to accept people on their own terms and not on their terms is what I think of as their teaching of the horizontal transmission of the Buddha Dharma. And I don't know, in my experience, a lot of the, like the Zen community in Hawaii is a great example of horizontal transmission. If you think about someone like Paula Arai, and her work in that book, Bringing Zen Home. Do you know that book? It's ethnographically researched stories of 12 Japanese women who use kind of family forms of Buddhism to help alleviate suffering in their own life. And what's so interesting is that some of those forms are some of the same forms that Jhana developed to make Buddhism accessible to people on the streets. So not hugely religious, but deeply oriented towards refuge. Anyway, Paula was open to that because she was from Hawaii and it was in the spirit of aloha that she grew up in to actually think, can I study these ethnographically to find out the language that's part of how they express it, rather than laying my own interpretation on top of it. I think I'm seeing legs moving, and I think it might be time to stop. So, I'm not gonna make you sit still. I don't think I could do that. But I think if we think of the yogic practices and forms as something that we can garden in ourselves rather than as a rigid form, and allow ourselves to experience our own responsiveness in accord with allies and examples who do that, that we'll be kind of on the right track for what to do this week. No idea, but I look forward to hearing whatever comes from here. After doing this meeting, thumbs together lightly, not like smushed together in stress. Okay? So thank you very much.